just a second here. I'll have the PowerPoint up and working. One thing my sister wanted me to mention is we actually have to pack up right after I'm finished speaking because we're heading out of town. I'm speaking at a conference tomorrow. And so if you want to purchase any of our books before we go, try to grab them right afterwards. I think we're releasing if we go to mealtime, but if you want to get those, grab them, please, after this session. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to talk about one topic, and then I'm going to radically shift and talk about something completely unrelated. Part of that is just because I'm ADD and I can, and the other is that we sort of planned it this way. So the first thing I want to talk about is some just thoughts on technology, navigating screens, and multimedia. And then I want to talk about some things for you to consider while you're in this season of being single, waiting for what God has planned for your life. And I realize in saying that, that like everybody's like, no, just skip the technology thing. We don't even want to hear that. But I would say that this issue of technology and screens and internet and all that is the defining issue of our era. This and sexuality, you know, these are the issues that your age demographic is dealing with more than any other two issues. I have four teenagers that live in my house, and I have two young adults, one of which, he puts it on his driver's license that he lives in my house. I don't see him very much. He works about three jobs, and so I hear him come in at like 11:30, and he leaves at 5. So technically, I think he kind of lives in my space, but he's not leaving a carbon footprint, so I'm pretty good with that. So this is why you don't want to listen to a guy with ADD, because it has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Oh, yeah, it does. So I understand this thing about screens and multimedia. That's where I was going with that. This is an issue. So here's a big picture that I want you to get. And let's tie this into the last session. We had four categories that we looked at: primary doctrines, secondary doctrines, tertiary doctrines, and adiaphora, which are kind of unessential or unimportant things. On the issue of how we use technology as Christians, what category would you put that into of those four categories? Oh, I stumped you. Is it a primary doctrine? Like what you believe about technology, will that determine whether you're saved or not? No, you can safely, I'm gonna go give you the right answer on that one. We're going to rule that out. This is not a primary doctrine issue. Secondary issue is, does the Bible clearly teach about this topic? Because if the Bible doesn't clearly teach on the topic, you can't call it a secondary doctrine. So there are issues like baptism, the Bible talks about. The second coming of Jesus, the Bible talks about. Gender roles, the Bible talks about. Technology, not directly, right? So I just eliminated another one. I'm going to make it really easy for you here. So we have tertiary and adiaphora. What do you think? Doesn't matter at all? Or tertiary, third level, it's a wisdom issue, right? So correct answer would be tertiary. This is a tertiary issue. It's a third layer. So it's important. It's important that we know how to think biblically, but what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to take biblical wisdom and apply biblical wisdom to it. So the very first principle that I want us to get, and this is what I teach my own teenagers, is that there's two different mentalities or mindsets that you can have as a human. The first one is having a mentality or a mindset of being a consumer, or having a mentality or mindset of being a producer. All of us consume. We all buy things. We use things. We are consumers in some ways. But a biblical worldview, a biblical perspective, is that God created us to work. He created us to take dominion over the earth. We see that in Genesis, where he says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. The subduing of the earth is part of the mandate that God has given to us here upon this earth. And so God created us to good works. You know, we see that within Romans, in Ephesians 2:10, that we're not saved by works, but we are saved unto God, unto good works, which God has foreordained that we should walk in them. So God has work for us to do, and that's one of the ways in which we should view our life, is that we're not just here to live for ourselves, we're not just here to serve ourselves, we are here to love and serve God by loving and serving other people. And one of the primary ways that we do that is through work. So we want to have a mentality of being a producer rather than a mere consumer. So rather than looking at technology as a good or bad thing, rather than looking at it as a sin issue, which it is not a sin issue, and it is not a good or bad thing, it is a tool. And in the same way that a hammer is a tool, or a knife is a tool, or an axe is a tool, technology is a tool. The thing you need to understand about technology is that it is a tool in almost exactly the same way that a hammer or a knife or an axe is a tool. It's a very strong and powerful tool, and it is potentially very dangerous. It is not a sin to have or use a hammer, a knife, or an axe. But you can use those things in sinful ways. The object itself is not inherently sinful. People who use hammers, knives, and axes can be sinful and can use those tools in sinful ways. So we have to stop thinking about technology as being something evil or something bad or even something that Christians should abstain from and not use. That's not a biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is that whatever you do, whatever your hand finds to do, you do it with all your might. And whatever you do in word or deed, you do it for the glory of God. So when we use technology, we're to use it with all of our might, and we're to use it for the glory of God. So there are biblical principles that teach us how we're supposed to interface with technology. So the question that I have then when my teenager comes to me and says, I am interested in using technology, and I need some money for that, I ask myself, what problem are you seeking to solve? What are you planning to build? What are you planning to create? What are you planning to make? What are you planning to produce that is going to add value to the world and leave the world in a better place than you found it? So then the teenager has to ask himself, in all of the 13-year-old wisdom that he can muster, well, Dad, this video game that I want to purchase will add value to the world by producing and making fun, which is good, and therefore we should buy it. And I say, wrong answer, but thanks for playing. So on the other hand, if my son comes to me at 17 years old and says, Father, dearest, O wise one, whom I respect and esteem, I would like to purchase some technology. And I say, oh, well, what is it you want to produce? What do you want to make? What do you want to create that's going to add value to the world and that is going to leave the world in a better place than you found it? And he says, well, you know, I was just thinking about how there are these people in third world countries that don't have clean water. And we need to bring awareness to that. And I was thinking about putting up a website that would help bring awareness and maybe raise funds to help bring clean water to remote villages. And maybe in doing that, we could help share the gospel. And I go, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm all for that. I will support that. I will encourage that. I'll put money behind that. I'm all in. So to me, the question is not, is the axe or the hammer good or is it bad? It's neither. It's a tool. The question is, what are you trying to do with it? And we are always, as Christians, living either in and for the kingdom of self or we're living for the kingdom of God. Now, if you come to my house in Southwest Michigan near Kalamazoo and you walk into my living room, you will see this banner in our living room, and this is in our living room because that's the high traffic area of our house. This is the place that we go through all day, every day. And this is our family mission statement. And we based it on a whole bunch of different passages in scripture that I'll spare you for, you know, giving you all the back references. I have them if you want them. But it basically says this. It says, we exist to know, love, and serve God, and love and serve other people. And this is the target for us. This is what I'm constantly trying to point our family back to. It doesn't say ends and means. I added that just for the PowerPoint. But one of the things that my boys like to do in our backyard is they like to do target practice, like archery. And sometimes they'll try to get me out there, you know, to participate with them. And I actually love target practicing because it's really good for my self-esteem. It boosts my ego. Because I have learned that when I pull back that arrow and I let it go, 100% of the time, and there's very few things in my life that I have 100% success in, 100% of the time, I hit something. And I'm like, yes, I hit it again. Well, then my boys do this thing where they get out like hay bales and they put a target up. And I don't like this part of it. Because as soon as the target comes up, my self-esteem plummets rather dramatically. I don't do so well with the target. I can overshoot the target by 20 feet. It's not pretty. So the problem with target practice for me is kind of like life for some people, that they don't have a target. They don't really know what their purpose in life is. And so they're just going through life every day surviving. They get up in the morning, they get dressed, they eat breakfast, they do their studies, they go to work, they feed the dog, they go to sleep at night, and they do it all again the next day. And they don't really know why they're here on earth. And so you need to have a mission statement for your life. You need to have a target. Why are you here? Why did God create you? Why did he put you on this earth? You need to be able to define your purpose, because you need to know, are the things that I'm doing helping me accomplish my purpose or not? So what I do with my children is when they come to me with some activity or some opportunity, I take them back to the target. And I say, okay, this is what you're aiming at. Go for bullseye. Does this video game that you want to buy help you to know God better? It's exactly what it sounds like when I ask them that question. Exactly. Same response. It was ironic. I was like, wow, you guys have been to my house. Does this video game help you to love God more? Equal silence. So will it help you to serve God? And how does God primarily want us to serve him? By loving and serving other people. Will this video game equip you to love and serve other people better? Deer in the headlights look. I'm like, that's going to be a no from me. I got to say, not all of my children love me, okay? I'm just going to say. They're like, why did we get stuck with him, right? And I'm like, well, basically that should be a lesson to you, that when you chose to be born into the Wayne family, this is what you get, you know? Do better next time. But basically, everything in life is a means, except for the ends. And there's only a few ends. The end purpose, the chief purpose of why we exist, is to know, love, and serve God and love and serve other people. But the means is pretty much everything else, for the most part. Why do you work a job? You say, well, I work a job to make money. Well, why do you need money? Well, I need money to be able to afford things. Well, like what kinds of things? Well, like a car. Okay, why do you need a car? I need a car to be able to go to work. Okay. All right. But why do you go to work? Well, to make money. Well, why do you need money? To buy things. Well, what do you need to buy? Well, a house. Okay, well, what do you need a house for? To live in. Okay, so the purpose of your life is to live. Okay, well, that's kind of a truism, right? That's kind of self-obvious, right? But is there nothing more than just existing? You'll find that everything that you do in life is really a means to something. And again, it ultimately comes down to, I'm either using all these means to love and serve myself, or I'm using all of the things that I have in my life as means to love and serve God and love and serve other people. So what happens is that we have an enemy of our souls, and he wants to pull us off mission. He wants to distract us and keep us from doing the thing that is most important, to cause us to be content with hitting something rather than hitting the target. And that's where technology becomes so important. There's a book by a guy named Neil Postman, who's a cultural analyst. He's not a Christian, but he's a very good thinker. And he wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death on Technology. And I think it's interesting where we sometimes look at entertainment and amusement as something that we turn to when we're tired at the end of the day and we just want to veg out, as we call it. But the root of amusing, if you look at it etymologically, is it comes from the Latin, and muse means to think or to ponder, like he's musing or he's thinking or considering or pondering something. So musing means to think, and ah in Latin means no. So literally, amuse means no thinking. It's really fascinating how telling the word amusement is when it comes to this issue of entertainment, because that's literally what we do. We shut the brain off and we just receive information. And that's a really dangerous thing to do. As I talked about earlier, the Bible tells us how we're supposed to put our mind on things, not to merely just allow our brain to atrophy as we're receiving information. So a new study came out last year from the University of North Carolina examining the long-term effects of technology and social media on teen social and emotional development. It said, the teenage years mark rapid brain development that makes teens highly sensitive to their environment. Technology-mediated contexts have the potential to rewire the development of rewire the developing brain. I was listening to an audiobook on the way here, again, using technology, to talk about technology. And I'm using a PowerPoint to talk about technology. This author was talking about how technology and social media has literally changed an entire generation emotionally and mentally. He was talking about a study that was done that compared the empathy of teenagers 40 years ago to compassion and empathy now. Their ability to feel compassion and relate to another person. And they said they have objectively proven that empathy and compassion has dropped 40% in your age range from teenagers 40 years ago. And they traced it to social media. I don't have time to, you know, give you all of the information or the explanation behind that and how they did the research. But it literally is rewiring the way that people process. And they said that part of it is just that this generation has seen so much that's shocking on their phones at such a young age that they don't feel anymore. They're numb. They're immune to being shocked. It used to be that parents had an ability to filter information before it got to their children and their teenagers. Now that information goes straight to the child in their pocket. You know, it's not the family television and the evening news where the parents could go, oh, that's a little dark, flip the channel. Now they bypass the parent and it goes straight to the young people. And they have seen so much at such a young age that they're just numb, that they're not emotionally impacted, even at seeing someone die on a video in a brutal way. They just shrug and watch a video of a cat. Because to them, it's just not real. And the amount of time that young people spend with social media and electronic staggering. Center on Media and Child Health says 56% of teens aged 13 to 17 play video games for an average of 2.5 hours a day. Smartphones, they say that teenagers are spending about 8 hours a day on cell phones, significant portion of that being on social media. We've got a whole generation of young people who no longer have friends. Not real friends. They're BFF. Their best friend forever. Or their bestie, as we call it, is that guy in Thailand that they game with at 2 a.m. in the morning. That's their best friend. They've never met that person. They never will. We have a whole generation of young people who have developed social anxiety to where they don't know how to have conversations with people and they're scared to go out to an event like this because they might be forced to talk to somebody. They're used to hiding behind a keyboard or behind a smartphone. They don't have real friendships. They have only virtual friendships. It's also the trouble of information glut. Neil Postman, in a book he wrote called Technopoly, says the world has never before been confronted with information glut and has hardly had time to reflect on its consequences. We have so many different news feeds and so many different messages on so many different levels that we have to try to filter when we're engaged in social media. It's overwhelming and it's emotionally exhausting. I saw another study 2 weeks ago that said that this generation of young people has more anxiety and more depression than any other generation of young people in the history of America. And they traced it back to largely the information that they're having to filter that's coming into their phones from all over the world. Things that they feel like they're supposed to do something about, and yet they don't know how to think about it. They don't know how to process it. They don't know what to do about it. And yet there it is, message after message after message. And it's just overwhelming them to the point where they have all this emotional anxiety and developing depression. I mentioned social isolation. That clock is my enemy. I just want to explain to you, if I can quickly, just how this has shifted, how it shifted our culture, technology, and not all in good ways. If you were to go back in time with me 150 years ago, and we were here walking in the mountains of the Appalachians on a dirt road, and we start coming up on a cabin, and we hear music coming from the front porch of this cabin, and we walk up there, what would we see? We would see probably brothers and sisters and cousins and neighbors sitting on a front porch playing instruments that they themselves made. Mountain dulcimers, mandolins, maybe a homemade banjo made out of a pie tin. Might not be great, but they made it themselves. Performing and playing music that they wrote, they composed. Singing in harmony, composing, making, creating music. And performing it in community with family and friends. You fast forward from the 1800s to the 1960s. How has music changed in 100 years from 1860 to 1960? 1960, how did people consume music? Well, they didn't produce it. They consumed it. They bought it. They would go to a store. They would buy a vinyl album. And I'm thankful in one sense that this has come back so that you know what albums are. I actually have a 22-year-old son who buys albums. For the life of me, I don't understand why. I'm like, hey, we created the CD in 1990. You're going retro here. That's a weaker technology, but he likes the vinyl for whatever stupid reason. But back when I was growing up in the 70s, we had a stereo console that sat in the living room that was the size of a coffin. You guys probably, you grew up Amish. You have no idea what I'm talking about. Nobody in this room has any idea what I'm talking about. All of my references are totally going to waste here. But how people, or they had a television that was massive, right? And they would sit and they would watch television. Well, what they were doing with this music is the family would sit and they would listen to the album. Who decided what music was played in the house in the 1960s? You're like, I don't know, because I wasn't there. You tell me, old guy. Tell me, boomer. So what it was mom and dad could afford to buy things. Because back in those days, teenagers were broke. They didn't have money, right? So mom and dad bought the albums and they played them. And the children grew up listening to the music that mom and dad chose to play and that they had to sit and listen to in the living room with the family. So they're not producing music anymore. They're consuming it. But they're doing it as a family because it played in the whole living room. And everyone had a shared cultural experience. Every person my age and older that grew up with technology grew up knowing what kind of music? Their parents' music. You couldn't not know it. So even today, if I walk into a store and I hear songs from the 1970s, I have these flashbacks of my parents, and I go, oh, my parents used to listen to that when I was little. Why? Because I didn't have a choice. It was a shared family experience, and they were the ones that were guiding that. Well, now what do we have? We have an iPhone with iBuds and a universe of me. And I watch movies, and I watch television, and I listen to music on iTunes. Or I guess YouTube is kind of a selfless social media platforms, because that's all about you. I have no idea where I'm going with this right now. But everything Apple is of the devil. You can even see the bite out of the apple. You know that's of the devil. Just kidding. But I'm now in a universe of one, aren't I? And where have we gone in 100 years? That's my point. In 100 years, 150 years, we've gone from young people being producers, creating their own music, in community and relationship to others, to us being consumers in the 1960s, buying and consuming music rather than producing it, but having a shared family experience, to now I'm a consumer, but I am a universe of one, and I'm completely shutting out everybody else in relationship around me while I consume entertainment that my parents don't even know what I'm consuming. Culture has shifted. And when you take something away, you have some gains, but you have losses. And also, I'm going to go ahead and say this. It just came to my mind. I'm going to get in so much trouble. I'm going to go ahead and say this. You have losses, and sometimes you don't get it back. I think you guys know me enough that you love me, right? No, that was not affirming. Now I'm not sure I'm going to say it. I thought we had that established. I don't know. I'm concerned, something I'm just going to throw out there to your church, concerned about something you might lose that you may not get back. As I've been sitting here listening to the worship, there's something beautiful that your church has that almost no other church in America has. That's that you know how to sing four-part harmony. Why do you know how to sing four-part harmony? Because you used to have books with shape notes. And you'd read those shape notes and you knew how to sing four-part harmony from reading those books. And then what happened? When churches moved to more performance where they had a piano and an organ, the only people who needed the notes were the pianist and the organ. Everybody else would look at the books, but they weren't typically singing the harmony parts. They're singing the melody. They're singing the lyrics. They're reading that. Well, even that's gone now. Now we don't have any notes. We have a screen that has the words. My concern is in one generation, your church is going to lose the ability to do four-part harmony. You may not get that back. Almost all churches used to know how to do that in America. And now they don't. And I'm not saying screens are evil. I'm using a screen. What I'm saying is there's trade-offs. You win some things and you lose some things. But some of the things that you lose, you don't get back. And some of those things are beautiful. Like the four-part harmony that you sing. So I'm not scolding you. I'm not rebuking you. Even if it's not reciprocated, I love you guys. But I want you to think about that not everything is better simply because it's techie. And maybe there's a way we can put the notes up on there so that people can not lose that ability that they have to sing and to teach four-part harmony. It's something to think about. Some obvious things, evil content on the internet, addiction, controlling us. Quick story. I was in Ohio. I was doing a parenting seminar. This mom and dad, probably in their late 40s, came up to me afterward, and they said, "We want to talk to you. We're concerned. We're burdened about our son. He's 19 years old." And they said, "We've never used this term before to describe him, but we're finally being honest with ourselves. And we believe that our son is a video game addict. We've started using the word addiction." And they said he plays video games basically all day, all night. He's 19. He's not going to school. He's not working a job. He just lives at home and he plays video games. If you ask him, like, "Hey, tell me about your life," you know, he'll say, "I'm a gamer." It's an identity to him. That's how he identifies. They said he refers to himself almost as though it's his employment. "I'm a gamer." So they said, "We decided at a certain point, like, this is so unhealthy, we're actually going to have an intervention. We're going to go talk to our son." And so they said, we had a conversation with him, and we said, "Son, you know, we understand you're 19 years old, but you still live at home, and we feel responsible before God for what you do in our home." So they said, "This video game thing has gotten out of hand. It's an addiction. We allowed you to do it. We introduced it to you, but we regret that, and now we want to try to make some amends here. So we have decided that we are going to take away your video game console and you are no longer allowed to play video games in our home." His response was, You can't give someone a gift and then take it away from them. That's not morally right. That's not just. So they said, well, we're going to go have a parent conference about that, and we'll be back. So they left the room, talked about it, came back, and they said, okay, here's what we've decided. We're not going to take the video game console away from you. It's yours. You can keep it. However, we are responsible for what happens under our roof, and you may not play video games in this house anymore because your life is out of control. And his response was, well, fine, I'm moving out. They said, well, it would not be our desire as your parents to have you leave home at this time for that reason, but we're firm on this. And so if that's your choice, and you're saying you're no longer going to submit to our authority, then I guess that's what you're going to have to do. He said, well, fine, I will. So he picked up the phone, and he called his buddies, and he said, hey, guys, I'm moving in with you. Well, it turns out that his buddies expect him to pay rent. He didn't see that coming. And he doesn't work a job, so he doesn't have any money. So he went to plan B. He took all the money that he has in his entire life, which is a bunch of coins in a piggy bank in his room, and he walked 4 miles down the road to Walmart, where he spent $40-something dollars in coins at Walmart to buy a tent. They said, for the last 2 days, our 19-year-old son has been living in our backyard, and he has run an extension cord to the outlet on the outside of our house into his tent, and for the last 2 days and 2 nights, he has been in the tent playing video games, and we've looked out there at 2:30 in the morning, and his tent is all lit up, and he is playing video games. We don't know what he eats. He only comes inside to use the restroom, and then he goes back out to play video games. What should we do? Now, one of the dilemmas about being an author and writing books is that people assume that you know everything about everything, which I certainly don't. The answer I wanted to give is, well, what I would do, I would go back in time about 12 years, and I would make some changes back there. But I share that story with you to say, I wish that that's the only story I've heard that's of its kind. It's not. Literally, the video game addiction has gotten completely out of control. I'm part of a Facebook group of homeschooled graduates. I know I don't look like it because I'm, you know, almost dead, but I did graduate from homeschooling. I was homeschooled myself. But there are these other people who are younger than me who are also homeschooled. And this one guy in this Facebook group who is now married, has a baby, I think. He's been married for like 5 years, maybe has a couple little children. And he's in his early 30s. He was boasting in this Facebook group that he had logged over 2,000 hours on one video game in the last 2 years. I got thinking about that, and I was thinking, that's 1,000 hours a year. Like, if you do that every day, that's basically 3 hours every day of his life for the last 2 years. He's a married man with children in his 30s, and he wasn't putting out a plea for help saying, I'm an addict, please help me. He was proud of that, and that's one video game. I assume he plays more than one game. My wife is on a similar Facebook forum with young women who are homeschooled, because she's also a homeschool graduate, and the wives of some of these guys in the group that I'm in are in the group that she's in, and they have this term that they use to refer to themselves. They call it video game widow. And they say, my husband is basically, he works, which is amazing they keep jobs, but they work, they come home, they play video games, he completely ignores me and completely ignores the children. I feel like a single parent. I'm raising the children by myself, completely ignored. My husband has an addiction. And it's like, there's like 10 of them in this one Facebook group of Christian homeschool graduates describing their husbands in this way. These are men in their 30s. I know I sound like I'm angry. I'm not mad at you guys. That's not okay. That's not the kind of life that you men want to live. Are you producers or are you consumers? Even if it's not evil content, you know, Paul says, do you not know that you're a slave to whatever controls you? Paul says, I won't be a slave to anything. I won't let anything master me except the Holy Spirit, right? Finally, accountability. We all need accountability, but accountability is not going to come looking for you. You are going to have to actively, aggressively seek out accountability in your life. I've had to do that in my life. I've encouraged my children to do that in their lives. It's something that you have to want. You have to pursue it. Because if you don't want it, there's a workaround. There's always a workaround for you to be able to get around accountability if you don't want accountability. But accountability is for your good. If you really want to have a pure heart, if you want to live clean before God, you need to put some structures in life. Make no provision for the flesh, the Bible tells us. So I believe that we shouldn't have devices that don't have accountability and filtering software and have somebody that is assigned to that that can look at what we're doing online and can keep us and hold us accountable. I do it. I encourage my adult sons to do it. You know, it's not so much a matter of, well, I have to do this. My parents make me do this. When you're at a certain age, you're going to have to decide it for yourself. And I'd encourage you to decide it for yourself now, that you want it, that you desire accountability in your life. And search it out, seek it out, put it in place. Find people who ask you the difficult questions. So what should we do? Should we amuse ourselves and have no thinking, or should we put our mind on something? Philippians 4:8, finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there's any excellence, if there's anything worthy of praise, think about these things. Social media, internet, technology, it can all be wonderful tools to help us accomplish God's purposes in our life. I use social media, I use technology, I use computers, I use PowerPoint. It's all good, but if it's a means. Is it a means to love and serve others, or is it a means to love and serve ourselves? So let me take a moment and pray and recalibrate, and then I want to jump into a different topic.